It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good to have you both back.
Thank you.
What do you mean both back? We have neither one of us has missed a single program this year.
Yes, but I.
Okay, Jav can come out of
I
the
revived
time
you from
now.
The from the cryogenic tanks that we keep you
this
in.
This year.
All right, so plenty to cover, but we're going to be doing picking up where we left off last week with the undercover stories for 2009.
Underreported stories.
Underreported. That's right. Yes, but we're going to do that after we do some brief coverage of a couple items that happened this week, none of which made it under our local billing. So we're going to jump right to at the national level, and Blackwater making the news this week.
Well, technically now they're XE Services, but yes, under Blackwater was the point at which several of their former security guards were charged with various crimes in conjunction with the massacre that happened in Baghdad several years back, where I believe 17 Iraqi civilians were shot in a firefight that, by all eyewitness accounts, was initiated and probably initiated in unprovoked fashion by Blackwater security guards. A federal judge this week dropped charges against the security guards stemming from that incident. It was very interesting looking at the reason why. Apparently, the guards, when they got back into the U.S., and remember, this is during the Bush administration, where they're very tight with Blackwater and its racist founder, Eric Prinz, they compelled, against the advice of State Department and Justice Department attorneys, they compelled the security guards, upon pain of losing their jobs, to give statements without lawyers present to State Department officials. Well, apparently those coerced statements were a constitutional violation because, of course, you know, they had the potential to be self-incriminating and so forth. And the judge rightly blasted the federal government for this. And it really makes you wonder whether the whole thing wasn't a setup to try and poison any possible prosecution to begin with on behalf of the Bush administration. It's very discouraging that at this point, one of the few cases where you have a really about as clear-cut a case as you could possibly want of Americans going in and essentially murdering a bunch of people for no particular reason at all, there's going to be no accountability for it whatsoever.
Yeah, and an interesting aspect of this, too, is that the federal prosecutors working on the case were aware that using those statements could taint the case, and yet they went ahead and did it anyway, and used them, essentially based a lot of their questioning of witnesses selection of people to prosecute in the case on those statements, as well as allowed a lot of the witnesses to read and hear excerpts from those statements
All of which are huge no-nos.
Yeah, enormous no-nos. And, it also highlights the use of independent contractors in a conflict zone, because it was part of the Blackwater security guard's contract that they would have to debrief with State Department, officials after an incident like this. So these guards were compelled to give these statements by the terms of their contract. The fact that those statements were used against them, it points up one of the big weaknesses of using private security guards in a conflict zone. So I think that's something people should be aware of, too.
One of the other implications of this as well, of course, is that there's a tremendous amount of anti-American resentment in Iraq itself around this case. And the fact now that the charges have been dropped and that there apparently will be no accountability is going to put a huge strain once again on relations between America and not just the general Iranian or Iraqi populace, but also the Iraqi government, such as it is.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on to some economic news.
Yeah, I noticed this week that while we're still hearing a lot of news about big banks paying back their bailout money so that they can pay enormous bonuses to their upper level management, that all of the big four mortgage lenders are actually doing the reverse. Not a single one of them has been able to pay back the bailout money that they've received from the government. That, in fact, three of the big four have lined up for further bailouts this week. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac actually went to the Treasury and said, you know, help, we need help. Our stock price is at $1 a share. We're worried that we're going to have further problems covering our mortgage losses. And so the Treasury this week announced that they were going to remove the cap on a $400 billion line of credit for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Essentially what that does, since the government already owns about 80% of both companies, essentially what that does is that gives the remaining shareholders of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac a guarantee that the companies won't default, at the same time that the government, the Treasury, has stepped back and refused to take a real controlling interest in the company and in these companies, and essentially what they should have done in the first place, nationalize them. Now, also this week, GMAC, another of the big four mortgage lenders, is lining up to get its third bailout of about $3.8 billion from the U.S. Treasury. So far, that brings the total money that GMAC has received from the government to $16.3 billion. And now, for the first time, the U.S. government will become the majority shareholder of GMAC, which is General Motors Financial Arm, the company that has provided the bulk of auto loans to people who have purchased cars from both Chrysler and GM, have got them through GMAC. But what really put GMAC into financial trouble was not their auto loans, but the fact that they got into the mortgage lending business and spent so much of their money on risky mortgage loans. Now, the fourth of the big mortgage lenders is AIG. They, as we all know, are majority owned by the U.S. government and regularly lining up for additional handouts. So I think that's something people ought to keep in mind, that while you hear about these big banks, especially big investment banks like Goldman Sachs, paying back the bailout money that they received, and it was questionable whether they needed it in the first place, the four big mortgage lenders are not only unable to pay back any of their bailout money, but it looks like they're going to need more and more and more.
And it really is money going down a rat hole, because any sensible investor would insist on control of that kind of level of investment in order to institute reforms and make sure that the cycle doesn't repeat. And, you know, by literally writing blank checks to these companies, the U.S. government is virtually guaranteeing that there is still going to be no more meaningful reform in terms of how these companies operate. They're going to keep going back and continuing to try to do the same things, and where taxpayers are going to continue to be on the hook for it.
Yeah, in fact, there's support in the Treasury and the Obama administration for making these companies continue to do the same thing. As we've seen, the Obama response to the housing market collapse is to shift the issuance of risky mortgage loans to subprime mortgage loans and loans with risky terms from commercial banks to these government-supported mortgage companies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to the FHA and other sort of government-owned entities. So really, taxpayers are taking on the risk now instead of big commercial banks of continuing to issue these risky types of mortgages to people who can't afford the homes that they're buying.
All right. Let's move on to international and events this week in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Once again this week, we have allegations of a massacre of civilians, this time in eastern Afghanistan in Ghazi Khan village, where Monday night U.S. Personnel in a night raid killed 10 people, mostly children, for ages from 6th to 10th grade, for 8 of them, who were basically handcuffed and shot. Now, according to the U.S. military, these people were members of terror cells in eastern Afghanistan, but according to all the local witnesses and also the investigator that was dispatched by Karzai's Afghan government to try and figure out what happened, they were school children, nothing more, nothing less. And When there have been demonstrations in several large cities in Afghanistan this week over that, and it really has just been a continuing problem throughout 2008 and 2009 that the United States is, as they say, in counterinsurgency operations, not winning hearts and minds because we keep going in and we keep killing people who don't deserve to be killed.
Well, and for me, what was more appalling about this, other than the fact that these are young, very young people, you know, I mean, a sixth grader is what, 12 years old?
Yeah, 11.
11 years old. Right. In addition to that is the way that they were killed. I mean, this was no drone strike. This was no airplane dropping a bomb from 30,000 feet.
Wasn't even self-defense. These people were handcuffed, lined up, and shot.
This was an operation where they went in, rounded up these young people, handcuffed
them. Out of their beds in the middle of the night.
Right. Took them out back and shot them. And to me, that's an atrocity. That is not an act of war. It's not a police action. It's an atrocity.
All right. Moving on to Cairo, Egypt.
Yeah. The Gaza Freedom March has united people from around the world, well over 1,000 of them, who have been attempting to get into the Gaza Strip, which, of course, has been blockaded for several years now by Israel and Egypt, attempting to get in with medical and humanitarian aid supplies. And they have been bottled up in Cairo all week by the Egyptian government at the behest of the U.S. Embassy and the U.S. government, to where there have been demonstrations all over Cairo. An 85-year-old American woman named Heidi Epstein, who is a Holocaust survivor, went on a hunger strike and was joined by several dozen other people. There are folks from Seattle in this delegation. And it looks now like, after the fact, some people are going to be able to get into Gaza, although not necessarily with all the aid that they had attempted to try and deliver in the first place. But it really underscores, of course, Egypt is a police state. It's a dictatorship. Hosni Mubarak has been the dictator there for close to 30 years now. And at the same time,
with U.S. support,
Egypt gets more foreign aid, and particularly military aid, than any other country in the world except Israel, from the United States. This is a throwback to the Camp David Accord, and the price for Egypt not attacking Israel is that we give the Egyptian dictatorship huge sums of money and kill toys for their dictators to play with. And so when the United States says jump, Egypt jumps, and the United States in this case said jump in terms of having the Egyptian riot police on several different occasions literally attack these demonstrators who were there from the U.S., from the U.K. and France and other European countries, from South Africa, from all over the world. So, you know, they did not get into Gaza as they'd hoped to, at least not as a delegation.
All right. Well, that then takes us to, leaves us about half the show for covering this year's underreported stories as you see it.
Well, that last part is most important as you see it, because there's no way we can get all of the underreported stories into one 15-minute segment. But let's hit some of the highlights locally. And Maria, feel free to chime in on any of these.
Sure.
Locally, I had several of them. One, of course, being that Susan Hutchison is Sarah Palin, except without the, you know, experience. it does raise the question, though, how of an abortion and gay-hating creationist who's never managed anything more complicated than a teleprompter almost become the most powerful politician in one of the nation's most populous and most liberal counties? She does it by lying about her quote-unquote bipartisan leanings and having every single one of her former buddies in the local media refuse to call her on it. This almost worked. As late as mid-October of this election cycle, Hutchison was ahead in the polling. And the only reason that she wound up losing by 20 points in the end is voters started focusing in on the race and realizing who Hutchison was. But they didn't do it with any kind of help from local media. That was very much an underreported story. Similarly, on the same ballot, we had a Seattle mayoral race, and Joe Malahan ran as an outsider in the August primary, and virtually nobody in local media reported that he did a complete 180 between the primary and the general election. He flipped from being an outsider, at least as much of an outsider as a CEO of a major telecommunications company can ever be, to inheriting basically all of the Democratic Party insider and labor leader and so forth, advisors and base and volunteer
money.
Base that and money, especially the money part, that Greg Nichols forfeited when he didn't make it into the general election. But, you know, a lot of the fairly credulous local media did not pick up on that narrative at all. And he very nearly won the mayor's race, in large part because, he managed to get through an entire election campaign without particularly defining himself and without, having the media try and do their job and actually define him for us. So, we had that. Also on the list, in terms of local politics, an underreported story is that the public really, 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 really doesn't want a tunnel downtown. You would never guess from the fact that the glowing, thank goodness the logjam is finally over, now we have a plan, yada, 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 type of coverage when the governor and the state legislature and the local city government cut a deal last spring for a deep bore tunnel under downtown Seattle to replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct, that the previous, 2 years previous, in the spring of, I believe, 07, the Seattle electorate rejected a tunnel option by 70% to 30%. It was overwhelming, and the biggest reason for rejecting it was the price tag. Now, the official spin on this was that, well, it's different this time because that's a different technology. Well, yes, it is a different technology. The cost was $3.4 billion in 2007. The cost of this plan is $4.2 billion. So, we're supposed to feel better about that somehow.
And that's a rosy estimate.
And that's a rosy estimate that doesn't include cost overruns. And we had for much of the year a lot of ambiguity over who exactly would pay for cost overruns when, not if, but when they occur. That still isn't particularly settled, although, you know, apparently some sort of a deal has been cut to get the city off the hook for a lot of that. But, you know, we'll believe it when we see it. One of the other local items hitting us where it hurts, while we have our various local political leaders, and I use that term somewhat loosely, continuing to have a love affair with big ticket projects, the cost of basics keeps going up. Bus fares are going up a lot. So are utility rates. So are a bunch of things that are basic governmental services that are being shifted off onto user fees and shifting off onto the fees that the people who can least afford it are being asked to pay because we have such a regressive local and state tax system.
Yeah, and this is at a time when the costs of other things are going down or staying the same. Because of the bad economy, but we're seeing things that people really rely on, like Job said, bus services and utility fees and all that kind of stuff. We're seeing those things go up and go up dramatically, and it's because they are basic government services.
Mm-hmm. Along those same lines, the whole fact that that tax reform is completely off the table in terms as a political topic, even to be discussed. Washington State has by far the most regressive tax system in the country. That is a comparison of the marginal rates that the very wealthy pay, and you know we are in the bottom 10 for that, and we are number one in terms of the percentage of income being paid out in taxes by people in the lowest 20th percentile of income in this state. And it's strictly due to the fact that we don't have a progressive income tax. What we have instead is a reliance on sales taxes and property taxes and B&O taxes, all of which are extremely regressive. You would think that with an enormous budget deficit staring the state in the face right now and similar budget deficits hammering pretty much every local government at the county and city level, that this would be the time to talk about some sort of a tax reform that isn't simply about adding taxes. It's about adding some over here, subtracting others over there, to make the sales tax, for example, lower, so that the net effect would be that for most people it would be a tax reduction, but it would still actually increase the amount of revenue and make more stable the amount of revenue as a percentage of the economy that the state gets. It just makes too much sense, but somehow an income tax is the third rail of politics in this state, and nobody will come close to talking about it, even though once you explain it, there's pretty broad support for it.
Yeah, and the governor's not even looking at it. She's proposing an extension of B&O taxes to services, to the service industry, like attorneys and accountants, et cetera. She's proposing maybe increasing the sales tax, but there's nothing on the table in terms of real tax reform.
No. And then last for local underreported stories for 2009, Greg Nickels' administration and its relentless campaign of harassing the homeless in this city, often by legally dubious means, things like seizures of property, some of the sweeps that have gone on, the harassment of encampments like Nickelsville and the various tent cities, the jungle, et cetera. It just has served no purpose other than that the city administration under Greg Nickels very clearly has just wanted the homeless to go away. And excuse me, but these are human beings and they've got to go somewhere. So rather than trying to open shelter beds, fund transitional housing programs, dealing with mental health and addiction programs, all those kind of programs are not being properly funded. And meantime, the hope is that their client base will simply decide to go somewhere else.
All right. That takes us on then to national underreported.
There's a national and international.
All right.
We mm-hmm. sort of mush them all together here. Do you want to talk about some of the economic ones?
Yeah, I had three that were in addition to what Joff has. Three economic ones. For me, the big three economic stories. First, the Fed, Treasury, and the Obama administration clearly this year were still trying to roll the economic clock back to 2005. And included in that story is the fact that it's been 12 months now and we've seen no financial industry regulatory reform at all. People can blame that on Congress if they want. They can blame it on all the focus on the health care reform bill. But I wouldn't blame it on Congress. I would say that the Obama administration clearly came out with their priorities, and that wasn't one of them. It certainly was not at the top of the list where it should have been. And the second big story this year was, it's very clear now, if you look at what's happened in the last decade, that we now live in a bubble economy. Because having repealed a lot of the regulations surrounding our financial system, what we now have is all of the checks and balances removed that smoothed out the big bubbles and the big crashes that followed afterwards. That clearly now we're back where we started when we began this big capitalist experiment where money moves into a bubble and then a crash follows and people suffer. And all of the regulations that we put into place over, 500 years to try to smooth out those bubbles is now being whittled away and disappearing, and we're starting to go back to the bad old days.
And it should be noted that the people who suffer are not the same people who are moving their money around so cavalierly.
No. And the third big economic story is, and I know Job had this as one of his most overhyped things, the so-called jobless recovery. And I want to talk about it in terms of not how it's often talked about on the business page and in the headlines, but really, the fact that we're in our second jobless recovery of the decade really points to the fact that the bubbles in the economy, the things that now make the economy expand, are becoming less and less connected to material reality. So in the past, where you would have a recovery in, say, the productive sector, where people were producing goods that could be sold, or in the services sector, which really relies on material reality, because you're talking about people and you're talking about labor and you're talking about a function of time. Nowadays, we're talking about bubbles in parts of the economy where people can just throw their cash after some kind of a derivative that's based on the price of something at some point in the future. It's so divorced from real material, from things that are really material goods or a function of time or a function of people's labor you can have an economy that is essentially becoming more and more and more jobless, more and more less and less productive, and yet you can still have all this money flowing around and you can still create these vast bubbles. I think that's something that we don't hear at all in economic growth.
I would actually put a slightly different spin on the same point, which is that we now have an economic policy, both nationally and internationally, that places no value whatsoever on how or whether people have access to a livelihood.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just not part of economic planning.
It's becoming more and more of just a pure numbers game.
Yeah. Want to run through some of these others fairly quickly. You don't have a lot of time left, but I had sort of a cluster of four of them having to do with the transition from George Bush to Barack Obama. One, and this, you'll have to remember all the way back to the beginning of the year for this one, how bad was George Bush as a president? Well, he was bad enough that most people, including most journalists, preferred to pretend that the last 8 years never happened. It's somehow like we hit this magic void in our political discourse where we went directly from Clinton and Monica Lewinsky to Barack Obama, and aside maybe from a couple of airplanes in New York City, well, nothing really much happened in between there. But whatever else can be said for or against Barack Obama this year, you have to remember that he inherited something that where the federal government was a catastrophe at virtually every level and in every imaginable way. That is the job that he walked into. And obviously he chose the job, he wanted the job, but it's still an unenviable position for any individual to walk into, and you can't expect any individual to wave a wand and make things all better. Particularly not, and this is my second piece of this, when you have an opposition party that is not only resolutely obstructionist, but refuses to offer any solutions of their own. We saw this with Congress all throughout the year, where there's just an unprecedented level of filibustering, of procedural delays, of attempting to derail the Democrats' agenda, but there's no alternative Republican health care plan. I mean, the alternative basically is, don't get sick, and if you do get sick, die quickly. That also being said, another underreported aspect was that Barack Obama is channeling Bush in an awful lot of his policies. It's really remarkable how many of Bush's policies have had no early cosmetic changes in the new regime. Torture, state secrecy, escalating war, Wall Street bailouts, but nothing for people actually hurting, don't ask, don't tell. It goes on and on and on. There are plenty of areas of divergence and a number of good things that Obama has actually done. But when people voted for that whole change thing last year, they weren't really thinking about tinkering with a few pieces around the edges here and there. And then, of course, the fourth piece of it is that it is truly remarkable and extremely underreported that Dick Cheney is not in jail yet. Other underreported, very briefly, cap and trade is a fraud. It's not going to get us anywhere near where we need to be in terms of affecting global climate change. And climate change is part of this, but there's also a larger story that we're headed for hell in a handbasket very, very quickly. The world keeps heating up faster than anybody projected. We're running out of natural resources, including oil. And, there's nobody in elite politics or in the mainstream media that's willing to point out just how potentially catastrophic the situation is in, or how completely inadequate our social, not just political, but social response to this has been.
Talking, as we do every week, with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And tell us, where do people find Eat the State?
Well, one thing you can do to help fend off that catastrophe is send us some money. Eat the State is a volunteer, a local community-based newspaper that comes out every couple of weeks with the news and humor and things to make you feel worse and things to make you feel better. And you can find it where you find free publications at bookstores, King County Library System, and coffee shops and so forth. And we are in the midst of our winter fund drive. So if you didn't get a chance to get that tax deduction in for 2009, you have a chance to do some early 2010 tax planning now. But we could definitely use your donations as well as your volunteer energy. And if you have a chance, we're also online at www.eatthestate.org. There's also a PayPal button there so you can donate quickly and easily and securely. Or if you want to send something the old-fashioned way, we're happy to take check some money orders and also orders for t-shirts or subscriptions or whatever you like, really, at P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And if you have questions, comments, tips, or if you'd like to do a tax-deductible donation, because we actually use an umbrella group, we're not a 501c3 ourselves because we endorse our candidates, so we're not eligible, but we do have a way to do that, contact us and we'll fill you in on it. Just email info@eatthestate.org.